All right, we're getting with the Mishnah on the top of Mem Bet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah says, "Mafkid ma'ot etzel chaveiro, person who deposits money with his friend. So ran, he wrapped him up, behiv shilan achurav, and then he put him towards his back. Rashi says, besudro, put it in his turban, in his cloak, and then he pushed it to behind him. Oh, shimasram libno vito aktanim, or he handed them over to his children who were minors. Vinaal bifnehem shaloki ra'ui, and he did not lock up the area properly. So that's something that we already saw earlier back on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph. There he is, chayav. He is obligated. That's the way that Rashi has the girsa vinaal, if you look back on Lamed Vav Amud Aleph. But the Rif and others have a girsa which says, oh, na'al bifnehem shaloki ra'ui, that it's a separate issue in the Mishnah. One is that he gave them over to his children or minors. And number two is he did not lock them up. He did not enclose whatever the object was properly. According to the Rif, who separates them, then now bifneim shaloka ra'oi means that the object or the monies, whatever it was that was nifkad, that he didn't lock up properly. According to Rashi, who says vinna'al bifneim shaloka ra'oi, means that he did not lock the children up properly, meaning if he had locked the children in properly, that would have been sufficient grounds for him to be a proper shomer, because even though the ketanim are not responsible for it, but since they were in a place or a location that was secure, and they could identify or scream if someone comes in to steal them, then they're actually helpful in terms of watching the monies. So that's how Rashi would learn it, that the na'al b'fneihem shaloka ra'ui is modifying the children, whereas the Rif learns it as a modifying the object that's being stored or watched. All these cases, chayav shalosh shimer kederach ha'shomrim. He's chayav because he didn't do what was behovent of someone who is a shomer, and he didn't watch it in a proper manner. V'im shimer kederach ha'shomrim. If he does watch it like the shomrim do, then he is patur. Meaning that we don't obligate him to do more than what is considered to be normal, or more than what he can anticipate. He has to act in the normal manner. And we're going to see in the Gemara that the Gemara gives suggestions as to types or descriptions of the way one must be shomer monies. And the last line in the Mishnah is very influential in affecting the Rishonim, Poskim, Achronim, in the fact that it all has to do with culturally what is considered to be the norm in those locations and in those places. And so if he watches it the way that people normally would do it, then he's exempt, even though it's not exactly like what's described in the Gemara here, or it's not considered to be the most efficacious type of Shmirah. Nevertheless, if that's the way people do it, that's enough to exempt him from responsibility. I understand in the Mishnah these are examples of individuals who didn't watch it normally. What's interesting here, in support of a little bit of the Rif's Girsa, which is that all the others, I understand, is not watching in the normal manner. But here it's done in plural. So that indicates that there are two other items, there are examples in the Mishnah besides the first case. And that would indicate more like the Rif, which is that you have giving over to his children who are minors, and also the possibility that he didn't lock it up or secure it properly. Ella, the first case in the Mishnah, so ran bishimlan achurav, where he puts it into sudar and he throws it over his back. What do you want him to do with the money? Here he has it on him. He's wrapped it up on his personal clothing. What else would you like him to do in this case? He stored them, wrapped them up, put them in a quote-unquote secure location. Amar Rova, Amar Rav Yitzchak, Amar Kral. The pasuk says, "Vitzarta kesef biyadecha, afal pishitzurim iyu biyadecha." Even though they're wrapped up, they have to be in your hand. So wrapping them up is not enough of a shmirah. Not only do they have to be wrapped up, they have to be in your hand. You have to be aware of them so they don't get lost, they don't fall out, they don't get taken from behind or pickpocketed. It has to be that the monies are wrapped up and secure in the sense that you know where they are, you have them in your hand. And now the Gemara goes off onto a tangent about this. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Olam yeh kasfo shel adam matzui biyado. A person's money should always be available to him, meaning that it should be liquid and available. Shenemar v'tzarta kesef biyadecha, that you keep the money on hand, not literally in your hand, but on hand, that it's liquid and available, because Rashi says, shim tizdamin lo schora, the schar ye mizuman lo. That if he all of a sudden has some sort of business dealing or opportunity to buy merchandise at a good price, then he has the money available. And it goes both on the positive side, which is that if he has an opportunity for revach or an opportunity for profit, that he should be able to invest quickly. But also from the emergency standpoint, if Chas V'Shalom needs the funds quickly, he has liquid funds with which to deal with the circumstance or the situation. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. So then Rabbi Yitzchak continues and says, Lo'olam yashlish adam et ma'utav. A person should divide his money into thirds. Shlish bikarko, shlish biprakmatia, v'shlish tachet yado. So this is brought here, again, a continuation of Rabbi Yitzchak's statement before, that a third of your money should be liquid, in your hand, not literally in your hand, but on hand. You have an ability to utilize it quickly. You have liquid funds. Shlish b'prachmatia means a third invested in business, dealings, trading, whatever it is that allows you to profit from the money. Shlish b'karka over here, you can interpret one of two ways. And the Marashah explains that they were, karka here can mean one of these two things, which is, either you can say shlish b'karka, which we're going to see in a second, is the way or to store money, otherwise known as putting it into a safety deposit box or into the bank. That's one possibility. Or shlish bekarka might be a third in real estate investments. So then you would have the breakdown be real estate investments, then you would have other investments, and then you would have a third that is liquid funds. Or you store a third in the karka, you have a third that's invested, and you have a third that's available for you for liquid funds. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Now, we have a number of memorot here from Rabbi Yitzchak in this context. Here's another memorot. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, ena bracha matzuyah l'medavar ha-samuy min ayin. Bracha is only available to things that are hidden from the eye. Shenemar, because it says, Yitzav Hashem itcha et ha-bracha ba-asamecha. That Hashem will command that there'll be a bracha. Basamecha really means in your silos, in your storage areas. But the way that we interpret it is samui, something that is hidden, something that is not obvious or open. And we have Tanu Bei Rabbi Shmuel, Eina bracha mitzuya, el b'davar she'eina sh'ayin sholetet bo. In addition to something that is not visible, but it's also something that people don't have their eye on. Shenemar, Yitzav Hashem itcha et habracha basamecha. So again, the idea that samui min ayin, that the bracha comes from something that is hidden, as Rashi notes over here, in a bracha shemit barech urevei me'elav, that it gets a bracha and it expands on its own. So we're going to see this in the continuation of the Gemara here, but this idea that if one does not have an exact measurement of the item, and the item is hidden from the eye, that it will expand, that it will have brocha that is mitsuya betocha. Now, part of that might have to do with the fact that when they harvest, then they bring it in. It is during the dry season, and so everything's extremely dry. Then over the period of time they're storing it, the moisture is in the air, there's the rainy season, and that causes the items to expand. We saw that before in the Gemara 2 days ago on Daf Mem with regards to whether you can deduct the amount or the chisaron because of that expansion that happens. So that partly might be what they're referring to, but it also has a more generic sense to it, which is, there's this idea of tzniut, that when Hashem wants to perform miracles, and Hashem wants to provide for people, He is more generous, or allows for miracles when they are samui min ayin, when they aren't obvious and not out in the public. What people bring as the example is the case with Elisha and the Isha, who was indebted and her husband had passed away and they were coming to take her children. And then the miracle of the shemen. There, Elisha tells her to go into the house, lock the doors, don't let anybody in, and just you and your children do it. So you see the miracle that takes place is because it's samui min ayin. That's something that's not obvious, something that's not out in the public. And others say that that's true even in the merchandise or the objects that a person trades in. That they shouldn't be big things or big items where people assume that there are big profits involved with it. It's always good to be under the radar, not to be something out in the public eye or obvious. That also includes not to be ostentatious or showy with one's wealth, but the idea that the brocha is found in things that are samui min ayin, things that are not, first of all, out in the public, but also things that are not counted on a regular basis, things that where you're not just looking at it every single day and checking on it and measuring it moment to moment. So that's it. This idea of the bracha that is on items that are samui mina ayin, on a bracha on things that are hidden, both from the perspective of no ayin hara, or not others seeing it, or others being curious about it, or obvious to them that you're profiting, but also from the perspective of you not spending all your time trying to measure and count and deal with the item. So then, Gemara continues, Tarabanan, Halech lemodet gorno, person is going to measure his goren, his threshing area, his storage, his silo, Omer, here at some of Nech Hashem Elokeinu, shetishlach bracha b'masei yadeinu, that you should send bracha into that which we have done. Hitchil amot, when he begins to do the measuring, Omer, Baruch HaShulech Bracha B'Kriya Zeh. Thank you, Hashem, for sending a bracha into this pile, this storage, Madad. If he then measures it, V'achar Kach Bireich, and then makes the bracha, or is it Tfilat Shav? That is a worthless tefillah. She'ein HaBracha Mitzuya. Because a bracha does not devolve upon, or is not experienced, lo b'davar shakul, something that is weighed, v'lo b'davar madud, something that is measured, v'lo b'davar manui, and not something that is counted, ela b'davar hasamui min ha'ayin, but something that is hidden from the eye, shenemar, yitzav Hashem itcha et habracha ba'asamecha, once again, quoting the same pasuk, this idea that samui min ha'ayin, this idea again, I think the Gemara is emphasizing it on two sides. First of all, the Gemara clearly sees this as being something that is normative, because they will only allow you to make a bracha before you have counted or measured the item itself. Which means that if you did it after you've counted or measured or weighed the item itself, it's a bracha levatala. That's how the Gemara is expressing it. It's a tefillat shav. It is a meaningless tefillah to say it after the fact. So first of all, the Gemara views that as being normative for that reason. Number two is the Gemara really emphasizes this idea of samui min ayin. And again, from both perspectives of the individual himself, so that he's not so intertwined with the item that he's counting it every minute, and not focused so much on the quantitative number or measured number of what he has, but assumes that he has and that Hashem will give bracha to that which is there, but also the idea that it's not out in the public and it's not being something that is done in a manner where others also know that there is wealth or bracha being created over here. And so that there's a need or necessity for things to be samui min ha'ayin, and for things to be in a manner that is tsanua. Interestingly enough, the Kesef Mishnah quotes the name of the Rambam that this issue only applies to trumot and ma'asrot. That this whole idea of this bracha where a person's going to measure the trumot and ma'asrot. The Maharsha is reluctant to accept that because of the quote, the pasuk that they bring as a proof seems to indicate that this is a broader normative din and not just about trumot and ma'asrot. But in the end, he suggests that possibly the reason that it might only have application by the case of trumot and ma'asrot is that in other situations, if you're going to sell it or you're doing something with it of a secular nature, you're not compelled to measure it. Your measuring it will stop the bracha, but that's not something you have to do. On the other hand, when it comes to trumot and ma'asrot, which is a mitzvah that is incumbent upon you and will force you to stop the bracha, there we tell you to go ahead and make the bracha beforehand so that the bracha should be in full force before you count it, and that should counteract the effects of having to do the mitzvah of trumot and ma'asrot and having to measure it. And the Kesef Mishnah says that's the point of the bracha here by the trumot and ma'asrot, is to show that the bracha of Hashem that they quote from these psukim over here really came true, and it's almost like a birkat hoda'ah rather than a bakasha. So this is all tangential because of Rabbi Yitzchok's statement before of v'tzarta kesef b'yadecha, that the way to store money is to have it in your hand. And then we parlayed into the other statement of Rabbi Yitzchok, that how to distribute your money and then where the bracha is found. So again, this was a small tangent. Now we come back to our Mishnah. Amar Shmuel, ksafim ein lehem shmirah ela bakarko. So now we're back on topic. And here Shmuel says the only way to store money is to put it or bury it in the ground. Amar Rava, Omode Shmuel. Rava says Shmuel agrees, Be'erev Shabbat ben Hashmashot. The guy comes and deposits the money with you right before Shabbat in twilight time. That the Rabbanan don't force you then to go and bury it in the ground. There's not sufficient time for you to do it. If he waits post-Shabbat and he has sufficient time to bury them in the ground and he didn't do so, then he'll be chayav because he was a posheya. If the only way to store the money, or the only proper way to store the money, is to bury it in the ground, and you didn't do that in a timely fashion, then you're going to be responsible for it. V'itzuber mirabonan hu, if he is a young tamar chacham, savar dilma mibayle zuzei la'abdalta, maybe he'll need the money for havdalah. So now, it's not clear here who the tzurbe mirabonan is. Is it the mafkid who is the tamar chacham? And therefore the shomer says, I'm not going to bury them right away after Shabbat, because he might need it to pay for wine for Abdullah. They were makbid not only to make Abdullah in shul, but also to make Abdullah la yayin. The Gemara in Brachot makes a big deal about it. It was an institution of the Chachamim that the Chachamim or the Rabbanim were very makbid on, and wasn't necessarily a practice by the Hamonam. And so there it says that they were makbid to do Abdullah la yayin. Gemara also says that it's a Siman Brocha, or brings the Brocha to be Havdil Aliyayin. So here the Talmud Chacham is makbid on that, so don't bury the money, because he might need it Motzei Shabbat to get his wine for Abdullah. That's one way to look at it. The other possibility is it's talking about the Nifgad. If the Nifgad has them, and he might need Yayin for Abdullah, maybe he would need those monies to use for Abdullah. So that gets into the question of, is he allowed to utilize those monies, or is it within his right to use those monies? It's a separate topic. The other possible way of explaining it is that he gets more time on Motzei Shabbat. If he's a Tzumei Mirabonan and he makes Abdullah Lakos, then the timely fashion for bearing the money is not immediately after Shabbat. You have to give him more time because he needs to make Abdullah Lakos, and then only then. So it gives you a buffer, a larger buffer of time afterwards. You can explain it in any one of those three ways. Vaidna d'shchiche gishushai. So today, where they're talking the time of the Gemara, where we have these people who are checking the ground, the way Rashi says is that they have these metal poles, yeah, and they're pushing them into the ground to see if there's anything below the ground or underneath. The equivalent today of the metal detectors, the guy running around with the metal detectors. And them shmirah ala b'shmei korah. So they have to change where they put them. Instead of putting them in the ground, they started putting them in the roof, above the rafters of the roof. Va'idna d'shchichei prumai. So today, now, we have these individuals who go up to the roofs and they peel back the roofs, where they lift up the slate that's on the roof. As the Begin Uchanano says over here, it comes from the Begadav Yufumim. That is, clothes will be in tatters or ripped up. So it's over here. They're peeling away the roof to see what's underneath the roof. So they know, because people are storing money there. So the easy way to steal, go up to the roof, open up a little hole, and they can take it out. In them Shmiral Benei Urbe. Then the only way to store them is between either bricks, or between the boards in the wall. And the Rabbeinu Chanan explains over here that it refers to what the Gemara in Bava Batra discusses in the first Mishnah, that a Bene Urbi is, when you have an Ariach, you have half a brick on one side, half a brick on the other side, which is a Tefach and a half and a Tefach and a half. And then they used to put a Tefach of filler material between the two rows of half bricks. So that tefach in the middle, that filler material in the middle, the plaster or the gravel that you put in the middle, there they used to leave the space and hide the items in that space. Amarava, Umode Shmuel Bikotel. Shmuel would agree that if you put them into the wall, that's like putting them into the ground. Vayidna Tishchichit Fochai. These days, now that they have these people, what they do is they go around and they knock on the wall to find the hollow spaces in the wall. And tofuchai comes from the word tefach, that they used to bang with their fists to listen for the hollow areas of the wall. And when they find the hollow spaces, they drill a little hole and they take out whatever is there. En lim shmirah b'tefach samuch l'karko, b'tefach samuch l'shmei korah. Then the only way to store them is in the wall, but towards the base of the wall, or on the wall towards the top of the wall. Because over there you won't be able to figure out that there's a hollow space, because you're up against either the foundation or up against the rafters or the boards, the cross beams that hold up the house. So then even if you go knock, you won't be able to determine where the hollow spaces are. So what you see here is innovation in the storage or the security of money because of the technological advancement of the thieves. So the similar thing today, that as thieves get better, then we change the mechanisms by which we store it in order to avoid the new methods of the thieves. So therefore they were developing or innovating in the way that the shomrim had to be guarding the money to avoid the new methods of the thieves. But what you see here, and I think this is what we mentioned in the Mishnah, that putting him in the karko, in shmira karko of Shmuel, worked for a certain period of time. until the thieves got smart and realized that all the money was in the ground. Once they did that, then putting it in the ground wasn't safe anymore, and they had to move or innovate in order to avoid or be a step ahead of the thief. Amalei Rav Acha b'Rei Rav Yosi the Rashi Hotam Tznan in the Mishnah Psochim says Chamish Nafla Alav Mapolet. If you have chametz upon which you have some sort of collapse or avalanche that comes down on it, harihu kimivuar. It's the equivalent of being eliminated or wiped out, meaning that you've mekayim the mitzvah biur chametz in that way. Anything that a dog would not find or dig up, that is considered to be mivuar. V'tana kama chafisat hakelev. How much or how deep is the area that a kelev, a dog, would get to? Gimel tfachim. That is 3 tfachim. So, hachamai, what's the din over here? How deep do you have to go into the ground in order to be considered secure? Bina and shlosha tfachim, over here do you require 3 tfachim? Oh, no, or maybe not. Amalei, hota mishum recha. Wait, the reasoning over there is because the dog is using his sense of smell to find the object. So therefore, bina and gimel tfachim, that's why you need it to be so deep, in order to be classified as mivuar, because then the animals won't dig it up and bring it back out. In order for it to be mivuar, it has to be something that is gone and won't come out again. It's not going to surface all of a sudden. But if a dog gets to it, then the chametz will surface. It's not considered mivuar. So that you need something deeper because of the sense of smell or the strong sense of smell of the dog. Over here, you're just trying to hide it. Get it out of people's view. Lo bina gimel tfachim. You don't need 3 tfachim. V'kama. How deep do you need it? Afram from Sichra says tefach, that all you need is a tefach, and that is considered to be sufficient. So now, the Gemara here concludes, and the Gemara quotes this in different places, that the only way to properly store money is to put it in the ground. And if you don't do that, you're considered or classified as a posheya because you didn't put it in a place that was secure. You didn't follow the protocol of securing money that was deposited with you. But if you do bury it in the ground, what is the din? So for a shomer chinam, it's obvious that he is patur, because he's patur from Geneva and Aveda anyway. Tosafot here raises the specter of tzarechiyun. Im shamram bekarka, if you put them in the ground, v'negdavu misham, they were stolen from there anyway, im shomer sachar chayav. Is a shomer sachar chayav in that case? Because what else could he have done? He is, in essence, an ones over here. He has no other mechanism for storing them. He did what he could have done over here. So why should he be chayav for Gneva and Aveda in this case? Now Tosafot says the difficulty in explaining it that way is that the Gemara only finds one instance where a Shomer Sechar is patur b'Gneva, and that's by listin mizuyin, which is armed robbers. The Gemara in Baba Kama was looking for options for Gneva that's ones where a Shomer Sechar is patur. They only come up with that one solution, which is listim mizuin. Armed robbers come and hold the guy up at gunpoint. There is an ones. He couldn't have done anything else. Here is a simple solution. He buried them in the ground, and that was it. He did what he was supposed to do, and then they were taken. Why isn't that considered the ones? For that reason, Tosafot somewhat leans against saying it over here, but he says, "Umikom makom ein svara klal shonim sag nevat ones shibitar ba ashomer sachar." Can't be, or logically, it just can't be, that a Shomer Sechar is never potur on Gneva, even when it's Gneva Tonis, and therefore he leans heavily towards saying that the Shomer Sechar should be potur over here. Ve'ein teretz, the whole v'chiev rachmana Shomer Sechar b'Gneva, afo pishi krova l'onis, that even though it's close to being an onis, that maybe that's it, the Torah is exeret ha-katuv, a Shomer Sechar is always chayav on Gneva, irrespective of what happens. And Tosafot rejects that thought process. First of all, because of the example of armed robbers, where we see there are exceptions to the rule, and Tosafot believes that this might be one of those exceptions to the rule, if you did what was in your power, and you did what was required, you did what was the standard of that time, then even as a Shomer Sechar, you should be patur. Tosafot even toys with the idea that maybe even a Shoel would be patur in that case. Even though a Shoel is not patur for Onsin, over here maybe even a Shoel would be patur. In the end, he rejects that and says that a Shoel would be chayav in this case, because he's chayav in anything except for meita machmat melacha. But Tosafot is trying to understand, what does it mean once you've done whatever is demanded of you, or whatever you could possibly have done, then where is your responsibility at that point in time? And Tosafot here at least entertains the possibility that a Shomer Sechar would be patur in this instance. How gavro, was this individual, da'afkid zuzei gabei chavre, He deposited his money with his friend. Odvinu b'tzrifa d'urbane. He put it in a, we'll call it a teepee, a hut that was made out of, you could have said straw, but over here it was made out of a revolt, willows, could have made out of reeds, and then ignov. It was stolen. So he puts it out in these little huts that they used to make in the fields. They were generally used either by the hunters or by the harvesters of the fields. They are, in essence, what we would call today a sukkah. And that's what they were in. The Gemara in Sukkah speaks about making a sukkah out of a tzrif. Durbane. Amar Rav Yosef. Afagav delinyan ganve nitirutahi. Even though in terms of gneva, this is a pretty good place to put the money because ganavim don't end up over there. They don't go there. They don't bother to look there. It's somewhere where it would be considered a pretty good shmirah vis-a-vis ganavim. On the other hand, with regards to fire, it is something that is extremely flammable. It is an area where, I guess, there were likelihoods of fire happening in these huts, and therefore he's considered to be a posheya vis-a-vis the fire. So therefore, it's someone who started out with a pshia, but ended up with an ones, and chayav. And therefore, he is chayav in this instance. And some say, even though with regards to fire, it's considered to be negligence, but with regards to theft, it's considered to be an efficacious or a good shmira. And we would consider it to be patur. That when you begin something with negligence and you end up, the problem that happens in the end is unforeseen or something out of your control, you are still chayav. And that's what the Rabbeinu Chananel paskens over here. V'hen alocha l'maset, t'chilato b'shiyah v'sof v'onis chayav. Tosfot over here tries to qualify the statement. We saw this back on Daf Lamed Vav as well, where Tosfot was dealing with this issue, which is, does there have to be some sort of connection between the pshia and the onis that happens? Is tkilato b'pshia b'sof of onis mean that as soon as there's negligence here, that the onis no longer is classified as an onis? Or does there have to be some correlation or connection between the two items? And Tosfot says over here, b'davka heicha sheyachol liot she'onis toya nera imlo pasha b'tchila. That the only way that this is true is if the ones might not have taken place had you not been negligent. I mean that there is some sort of correlation between the two items. It's what is otherwise known in legal terms as but for cause, which means that it's only because you put it out in this hut that it ended up getting stolen. It's not necessarily the reason it got stolen, but had it not been in the hut, it wouldn't have been stolen. Now, that doesn't mean that putting in the hut is negligence, but your negligence with regards to fire put it in a place, and that place is what resulted in it being stolen. And therefore, you are chayav, even though it's not the proximate cause. You were not the direct cause for its theft. It wasn't because you did something negligent. It wasn't your action directly that caused the theft. Nevertheless, your negligence with regards to the fire put it in a place or a situation in which the gneva took place. And therefore, Tosfot requires this, at least that threshold. In order to be tchilato b'shiyah b'sof ones, he requires at least that connection, that thin connection between the pshia and the ones, that without the pshia, the ones would not have taken place. Or at least you could speculate that the ones wouldn't have taken place. It might have happened anyway. That's what we saw before in the Gemara. Malach ha-mavit, malihocha, malihotam, if it dies in either place, then that's not considered to be your pshia as the gorein. Or if you believe that avir da agma katlo, that the air quality in that place killed him, then even though it's not clear or certain that's what happened, but if you can make such a claim that your pshia was possibly the resultant onus that came about, that's enough to make you chayav and tklato pshia b'sof onus. And Tosfot emphasizes this here, as well as Tosfot later on in Ayin Chet Amud Aleph, does the same thing with regards to an animal. He says that an animal that overheats and then dies, but it overheated in a place that it shouldn't have overheated. It would have been worse off in the place that he was permitted to go to, and it goes to a place where it's less of a problem and it overheated. Is he chayav? Vim tomar lamanda amar leel tchilato b'shia b'sofu bonis chayav amai patur ha tchilato b'shia haya l'inyan chuklaka. He took it into the mountains where it's negligent because it could slip the animal on the mountains. As far as overheating, that's a better place for the animal to be because in the valleys it would overheat even more where he had permission to go. Now he's going to the mountains that are cooler and it overheats. Certainly that's an onis in that case. Be'esh lamar t'lo mechayev el ba'onis she'esh litlot she'melo haya mishaneh efshar sh'lo yabaha onis. So again, you're only chayav for t'chilato b'shia b'sof onis if in cases that if you did not make that change, there's a possibility that the onis would not have taken a base. Of a hocha, ki huchma bahar, if he overheated on the mountains, kol shukim demlo shina, fayeloch bibikad av a huchma. If he took it in the valley, certainly it would overheat it and would have had a problem. So there you can't see a contribution of taking him into the mountain as being the cause for the death of overheating. And so even though you're a posheya, you're negligent for taking him up there because he could have slipped, if he dies from overheating, there's no correlation between the pshia, the negligence of taking him into the mountain, and the overheating. And because of that, even the one who says, t'chilato b'shia b'sof ha'onis, you are patur in that case. And that's what Tosfot is saying over here. You have to correlate, or you have to say that there is some plausibility that your action, if it were not for your action, that this thing would not have been stolen. That's what makes you chayav over here. Again, the fact that we can correlate between your negligence and the stealing, that makes it already that you are responsible, you're chayav. Now, had it been that the hut was fireproof and there was no negligence there, then you put it there and it got stolen there, that might have been fine because vis-a-vis ganavim, that's considered to be a nitiruta. That is considered to be a good way to store the money. So had you not had the pshia, then you would not be held responsible. It's only because of the negligence that then puts you in a position, exposes you to the gneva, that makes you chayav. Oh, gavro, dafke zuzei gavei chavre. He deposited money with his friend. Amalei, havalei zuzai. Says back to him, give me my money back. Amalei, lo yadana heicho dvinu. Says, I don't know where I put them. I don't remember where I stored them. Alta the kamei durava. So they came before Rava to adjudicate the case. Amalei, kol yadana pshiuta hi zilshlim. So again, we saw this earlier in the Gemara as well, in Daf Lamed Hei. Then anybody says, I don't know, is the equivalent of being negligent or a posheya. And therefore, when he says, I don't know where your money is, he has not discharged his obligation as a shomer. He's now negligent as a shomer, and he has to pay for it. And even though, in general, a shomer chinam is patur when it comes to gneva and aveda, so why isn't this similar to an aveda? That's true when the item either ran away or got lost in a way which he says, I placed it here, but then I forgot where it was. But not in a place where he says, I have no clue what happened to the item, because that's already indicative of some sort of negligence in his watching of the item. How gavra, da'afke zuze gabe chavre, person deposited money with his friend, ashlaminu li'ime. He handed them over, he gave them to his mother, votvina bekartalita, and she put them into a chest, or some sort of storage area, the ignov, and they were stolen. Amarova, heche nedaine daine lahai dino. How should a judge adjudicate or deal with this situation, this case? Namele the day zilshlim. If we say to the shomer, go pay for it. Amar, ko mafkid, adat ishto banav hu mafkid. We said before that a person who deposits an object or an item with a person expects not only this individual to be involved in the business, but his whole family to be involved in the business. The way the Rabbeinu Hanano phrased it over there is that just like the individual gives his money to his own family to watch his own money, then when you give him money to watch, he'll also give it to his family to watch. And that the whole family are a part and parcel of the business. And so too over here, what's interesting over here is that the mother is included. It's not just his wife and his children, but his mother. So the family business involves not only his direct family who's living with him, but maybe even his mother, his father, or maybe they are living with him. So namele leime zile shlime. So why don't we say to the mother, pay up? Amra lo amarli delabdi dininu. She said, I didn't know there was someone else's money. I thought it was my son's money that he was giving to me to watch. Dakbarinu, because then had I known it was a third party's money, I would have buried them in the ground. Now that I thought it was his money, I put him into the chest. Namale amai lo amartla. So let's say to the shomer, why didn't you tell your mother that it was someone else's money? Amar koshachain dechi aminala dininu. It's famous darabahu. A mother with her son's money? A mother with her son's money is super careful. I thought if I didn't tell her that it was the other guy's money, she'd be even more careful because it was my money. And she'd be very makbid on it. Eloma Rabba, so what do we do here? Mishtaba ihu dahanu zuze ashlaminu liime. He takes a shvua that he handed the money over to his mother. Mishtaba ime dahanu zuze utvinu bekartelito. And the mother says, or takes a shvua that she put them into the chest, vignov, and they were stolen. Upator. And they are both exempt over here. So first of all, let's just talk about, we spoke about this back on Daf Lamed Vav with regards to Shomer Shemasa the Shomer. Two of the issues with Shomer Shemasa the Shomer is number one, which is Ein Ritzoni Shi Poktuni B'Yad Acher. That's Abaye's reasoning, which is I don't want my item to be with someone else. That is not an issue here because Kol Mafkid Al Dati Shto Banav Hu Mafkid. When you give it over to the person, you expect it to go to his family members as well. Number two is this idea that a person, when he deposits with the individual and his family members, means that you also can't make the claim of Rava's claim about Shomer Shemasa Shomer, which is, At Mehemet Li B'Shvua. I believe you with the Shvua, I don't believe that other party with a Shvua. Over here, if you know that he's going to have his family members involved, that means that you have to understand that you're going to get a Shvua, possibly from one of his family members. And that's what Tosfot says over here. Omer Rabbeinu Taim, Da'ainu Linyan Sheinu Yechol Lomar Lo, At Mehemet Li B'Shvua. This statement over here that the family's involved in the business means that the mafkid can't say, I don't believe your family members in a shvuah, because he knows they're going to be involved in the business, and he has to take that into consideration when he deposits it. Aval, impashu. What happens if the mother here was a posheya? She did something negligent with the money. Afilu ein lehem mali shalem, yishalem anifkad. Even if the mother has nothing to pay for him, still the shomer has to pay. Dimokain, Kaumashuv got it's a balabait, because then what's gonna happen anytime someone gives something to a balabait, to Boishtovatochal, his wife will come and eat it up, Vitipater, and I'll be Pator. He'll say, ah, my wife did it, she was a Pusheya. That's why his mother has to take a shvua that she was not Pusheya. Because if she was a Pusheya, a first line of defense would be that she is Chayevet, that she is responsible to pay. And the second line of defense would be to come back to the original Shomer and say, now you gotta pay, you're on the hook for it. So the Rabbeinu Tam says that even though when we say that a person deposits with the individual, he expects the family members to be involved, that if they acted appropriately, if they did what they were supposed to do, if they did something wrong, that family member will be responsible. But it's not that the individual who he gave it to is now off the hook because the other family member is on the hook. The original individual is still on the hook if the family member can't make restitution or can't pay for their negligence. So if there is pshia here, it does not exempt him by the fact that he's able to give it over to another family member, and that family member was the posheya. He is still a responsible party. It's not as if he now connected between the depositor and his family member. He still sits in the middle, and it's not like your classic case of Shomer Shemasa the Shomer. There we saw models, based on the Rishonim, that Shomer Shemasa the Shomer is as if he became an agent to give it over to the other Shomer, and now the case is between the Mafkid and the final Shomer. Over here, that's not the case. Yes, the final Shomer has to declare what happened to it, but it does not exempt or remove the responsibility of the original Shomer. There were models like that in Shomer Shemasa the Shomer, like the Ramban, but here, the Bayan Otam makes it clear that the Shomer Shemasa the Shomer over here is still on the hook, even though here it's permitted, because it's not really a Shomer Shemasa Shomer, it's all part of the family business. So this goes against what the Rabbeinu Hananel said before, that, well, whatever you would do with your money, yeah, you would do with someone else's money. Because over here, the Gemara differentiates and says that with regards to his own money, the mother thought the safe for putting it in this chest was sufficient, even though if she was really a Shomer, it was third-party money, would demand that they put it in the ground in order not to be a posheya. So here you do see some sort of differentiation where she was a little less makpedet on her son's money than third party's money. Although the son didn't think that. The son thought that she would be as makpedet on his money as she would be with the third party's money. So the son had that wrong. The son's view was that she would be makpedet in the same way. And therefore maybe that is supportive of the Rabbeinu Hananel's view. Right, so now the Gemara says, another case, how opitropo. We had this executor that was appointed the Yatme for the Yatomim to take care of them. To Zavin Lahu Torah the Yatme. He went ahead and bought an ox for the Yatomim. whether to do business with the ox, whether to use it to plow the fields, whatever it was that he's going to do with this ox. And in the interim, he gave it over to a ro'eh, to a cowboy, to watch it or take care of it, basically to raise it, feed it, and take care of it. The ox did not have teeth with which to eat. Rashi here translates kache as being gums, which he does all over Shas. Tosafot all over Shas, you can see here in the Masorah of Shas, he quotes it, argues on Rashi and says that kache are your molars. So kache are the molars, shine are the incisors. That's the way Tosafot reads it over Shas. Rashi always reads it as the gums and the teeth. But either way, he was unable to eat umit, and it died. So the way the Rabbeinu Chananel explains it over here is that this animal was able to eat, meaning that if you pureed its food or you soaked it in water first, it was able to eat. But it couldn't eat regular food. When it was given regular feed, it couldn't work with the regular feed because it didn't have teeth to break it down. When it was with its owner, safile gvul, he used to give it kneaded stuff, which is it was added to water, los lafile umit. That's not how they fed it, and so it ended up dying. Amar Rabbi Baracha, Heichani Dainu Daine Lahaidina. What are we going to do in this case? Namele the Otropo Zilshlim, we say to the executor, the representative of the Yatomim, go pay for it. Amar Ana the Bakra Misartia. I gave it over to a responsible party. I gave it over to the shepherd, the cowboy, to watch it. He should have taken care of it. Namele the Bakra Zilshlim. You go to the cowboy, the shepherd, and say, you pay for it. Amar Ana Bahade Tore Ukimte. I put it together with the rest of the oxen, the rest of the cows. Ukhlo Shadile. I gave it food. I put feed in front of it. Lovi Yadina Dilo Acha. I don't know, or I had no idea that this animal didn't have the ability to eat. Nobody informed me of that. Michte. Bakra Shomer Sachar Diatmehu. In the end, the Bakra is a Shomer Sachar, a paid guardian for the Yitomim. Ibayale Leyune. We expect more qualitatively from a Shomer Sachar. He should have looked into the matter. Iikab say the diatme, if this is going to cause a loss to the Yitomim, meaning that he should have been much more careful about this. So Achanami. So over here, why don't we say the same thing? That he should be held responsible because he's a paid guardian of the Yitomim. He should have looked into the matter. He should have seen that the animal, or checked that the animal wasn't eating or wasn't getting sufficient nutrition. So this is a case here where the Yitomim don't lose out. How is that? They found the original owner of the ox who sold it to the Yitomim or to the executor. And they got a refund. It was a mekach taot. They got a refund on the cow because it was sold under false premises that there was no notification of the fact that it didn't have teeth. Elaman kotoin. So then the question is, who is making the claim over here? Who's out money that is making the claim? Over here, until now, we thought that the claimants were the Yitomim who lost their money by buying the shore. So do they go after the epitropus? Do they go after the executor of their estate? Or do they go after the bakra? They go after the shepherd? So that was the question. But now we solved that problem because they got a refund on their money. So now who's the claimant over here that Rova's worried about? How do we adjudicate this case? There seems to be no claimant in the case. Mar says, Mari de Torah Kotoin. It is the owner of the ox that is making the claim over here. He is going after either the executor of the estate or, more likely, the roeh. He's going after the shepherd. Baile the Odaan. You should have let me know that the animal didn't have teeth and we could have refunded the money immediately. My modinle, me the yoder the mekach tovi. Wait a minute. If it's the owner of the animal, he knows that he sold the animal without teeth. He's the one whose animal it was. What do you mean, let me know it doesn't have teeth? He was the one who knew that it didn't have teeth. It says, b'safsira, talking about a broker, zabin ha'acho, mezabin la'acho. He buys and sells, he brokers between them, he's not really checking the animals out, and so therefore he had no knowledge. So he says, you should have come back to me immediately and told me that there were no teeth. And that way, I wouldn't be out the money now. Because now I have to refund the Yitomim their money because of the Mekach Ta'ot. Maybe he'll be able to go back after the original owners and get his money back because they didn't disclose the information. And then either the broker or the original owner now wants to go after the Ro'eh for their negligence in not taking care of the animal. Hilkach. And therefore what do we do is, Mishtaba ihu dolo biyodo. The safsira, the middleman, the broker takes a shvua that he had no knowledge of what took place. Umishalein bakra d'mei basar bezol. And then the cowboy, the shepherd over here, pays the value of the shore on a diminished basis, which means cheap meat. So now, this is a machloket between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, how to read this. First of all, why is he responsible over here? And number two is, why does he pay basar zol? So now, you have to go through each of the parties over here. The safsira, the broker, gets out of the problem by saying simply, he wasn't informed. The owner never informed him of this information. He's not a guy who checks these things out. He just makes shiduchim. He brings the animal from here. If somebody needs an animal, he buys and sells it. Whatever information is given to him, he discloses. If he doesn't have information, he doesn't disclose it. So over here, he takes a shvua that he had no information, and therefore he couldn't disclose the information. But the information was never passed to the apitropos, because then the apitropos would have been responsible in this case. The apitropos doesn't have the information because he never dealt with the owner himself, and he dealt with the middleman. Because had he known the information, it sounds like he would be responsible, and he would be the posheo over here because he knew the information, and then didn't pass it forward to the roeh, which is interesting. Can an apitropos, an executor, be held responsible for negligence? The Gemara and Baba Kama seem to indicate no, that he would not be held responsible for that because of the fact that people won't volunteer to be executors of the estate if they're going to have to pay out of pocket for items like this. So Tosfot says from the Gemara and Baba Kama makes it sound like you wouldn't be chayav yet. Our Gemara seems to indicate if he was a posheya, if he knew the information, he would have been responsible over here had he not given it over to the roeh. He would have been the responsible party. So Tosfot differentiates and says that the case in Baba Kama is a case where the animal of the Yatomim is doing damage. We're going on and doing damage. We appoint an executor to take care of the animal. Over there, if you make him responsible for the damage, nobody's going to volunteer to take up that position because you're not protecting the Yatomim. You are basically, it's a tikkun olam, as Tosva calls it. It's for the society at large. It's for the benefit of society that we put the apitropos in to protect other people's property from this shore of the Ktanim. And in that case, people will not volunteer if you make them chayav. Over here, where the individual gets, as we said before, a nemanut, or he gets a stamp of approval of a Beit Din, that this is considered to be a person that Beit Din relies on, that's enough of a remuneration that this individual will be held responsible if he is a posheya. And people will not take up these positions because of that. And therefore, Tosfot says over here, the individual would be chayav if he was a posheya. Now that we determine that he's not a posheya, because he had no information as well, it was given over to the roeh. And the roeh over here is held responsible because he's a shomer sachar, he's a paid guardian of the shore, and he should have looked into the matter and seen that the animal was not eating. There is some quasi-negligence over here. But in our scenario, the Yatomim found the owner, said there was a mekach ta'ot, you never disclosed the information, therefore we're getting our money refunded. So as far as the Yatomim are concerned, they have nobody to go after because they got their money back, they're whole. The only person out of money now is the original owner, and now the only person that could possibly be responsible is the shepherd. The question here is, what do we do? So Rashi says over here that hold that the Yatomim, since the Yatomim have a right of claim against the roeh, because he was a shomer sachar mehem, yamdu balim bebekom yatomim vigovim. Broker, the original owners step into the shoes of the Yatomim and they make a claim over here. Miu imave mafsid de Yatomim. If the Yatomim were the ones who lost it, lo yasip shara b'mamon Yatomim v'shalem bizol. If it was the Yatomim's loss, we wouldn't let the shepherd get away with paying the lower amount, this cheap meat. Tiyame delab b'nei michilaninu, because Yatomim can't be mochel. On the other hand, aval achshav shumi gavel balim. But over here, where the original owners are coming and paying the Yatomim, and then they're trying to go after the roeh, but it's not, as Rashi calls, a full-fledged pshia. It wasn't like the roeh was totally negligent. We just would have expected more from him. So since we would have expected more from him, if the Yatomim make a claim against him, we're going to make him pay fully. But here, where it's someone trying to step into the shoes of the Yatomim, we're going to say, all right, he doesn't have to pay the full amount. He pays basar zol. Rashi says basar zol, he mentioned this actually early in the Masechta, means two-thirds of the market price. Whereas the Balei Tosfot back then said basar zol means the lowest market price for meat out there, for the lowest quality meat out there. So Rashi says that in the end, it's a pshara, it's some sort of compromise to say, look, the ro'eh is not completely innocent over here, but he's not completely negligent. And the owner is somewhat problematic over here because he didn't disclose the information, but he does have a right to go after them because he basically bought those rights from the Yatomim when he paid the Yatomim for the Mekach Ta'ot. So now he can step into their shoes and go after the ro'eh. So we come up with this compromise that he pays in basar zol, that he pays for cheap meat, or the value of cheap meat. That's the way Rashi terms it. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam argues, and many of the Rishonim follow in his footsteps, perish the din gamurhu. Not like Rashi, that this is a compromise, but rather this is the din. Because dimayam odio, had he told the safsira, had the balim made the proper disclosure originally that this animal didn't have teeth, he has safsira shochto miyad umochro. The middleman, the broker, would have shechted it right away and sold it off immediately bizol. He couldn't have kept it around until the Yom HaShuk because it would have died before that point in time. So had the Balim given the proper disclosure, then this is exactly what he would have gotten for the animal. He wouldn't have gotten full price for the animal. He would have gotten the price of shechting and selling it when it's not Yom HaShuk, which is basically Basar Zol. So all he's entitled to is what his losses were. His losses are that they would have shechted it immediately, sold it immediately. Instead, it went through this whole scenario where it ended up in the hands of this Ro'eh, and this poor Ro'eh now is on the hook for it, but he's only on the hook for what the Balim would have gotten had they told the truth up front. Therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam says it's Me'ikar Hadin, that it was this way. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam's assumption is that had they known the information, the animal would have died anyway, and therefore you had to shecht it right away. The way the Rabbeinu Chananel explained it before is that you could feed the animal in that way, it would have just been more work, or it was more difficult, and therefore you would have had the ability to sustain the animal. So over there, that seems more like what Rashi is suggesting over here, that it's a compromise, because the animal wouldn't for certain have died had you disclosed the information. So now in the end here, we have a scenario where we're dealing with all these different parties. According to Rashi, the Balim are a little bit negligent over here because they didn't disclose the information. The Safsira, the middleman, had no idea. He takes a Shvu'ah in order to get himself out of the problem to say that he didn't know the information and he did not fail to disclose the information forward. The Apitropos is off the hook because he gave it to the Ro'eh and that protected him because he gave it over to a Shomer Sachar. Had he not given it to a Shomer Sachar, the Apitropos would have been on the hook. Because Tosfot says that the apitropos is a posheya, and even though generally an apitropos gets indemnification from paying, when you are negligent, you are a posheya, then you're on the hook. And the apitropos would have been on the hook here had he not given it over to the ro'eh. The ro'eh over here is on the hook. According to the Rabbeinu Tam, Mi'ikar Adin, he should have figured it out. He should have done what was needed. And therefore he's on the hook for the basar zol. The other hand, for Rashi, he is a posheya somewhat. He's not a full-fledged posheya because he should have figured it out, but it's also a crazy situation. It's not your normal type of situation. Since he's only a partial posheya, we only keep him on the hook for a portion of the money. And this is some sort of compromise that he pays for basar zol. The broker, the original owner, refunds the money because it was a mekach ta'ot, because he failed to disclose the information. That failure to disclose makes him, according to Rashi, partially responsible. Or according to Rabbeinu Tam, makes it that his animal is only worth basar zol. But the last thing is that he does get the right, because he pays off the Yitomim in the Mekach Ta'ot, he gets the right to step into the shoes of the Yitomim and then go after the Ro'eh. And here, Tosfot brings up an issue and he says, "Umesfekele b'hadin alibid the Rabbi Yossi. This din, according to Rabbi Yossi, damar, tachzor para le balim arishonim." The Mishnah back, when we saw in Lamed Vav, that Rabbi Yossi says, how could it be when you have a socher, a renter, that gives it to a shoel, and then it dies, ba'onis, etzo the shoel, it just dies a natural death with the shoel, that the shoel pays the socher, and the balim are out of luck. Rabbi Yossi says, how could it be that this guy's doing business with the other guy's animal? So Rabbi Yossi over there says, you have to pay him back. The shoel has to pay back the money to the balim. Alma, maskir b'makom socher kai. The maskir, the person who rented out the item, steps into the shoes of the socher, of the renter. The Ilay Dine Bahad Shoel, and he has a right to go after the Shoel. Bahachanami, also in our case, Safsira b'makom yatme kai, that the middleman steps into the Yatomim's place. The Ilay Dine Bahad Bakra, and he has a right to go after the Ro'eh. Tkilu Havi Shomer Shalo, as if he was his Shomer. Oh, Dilma, lo dummy. Or maybe the cases are not exactly alike. Tahatam vadai kayim maskir b'makom socher. Over there, it's obvious that the maskir steps into the place of the socher. The socher shayach begufa para. The renter has rights in the animal. When he rented the animal, he becomes, in a sense, a quasi-owner of the animal to utilize it or do things with it the way that the owner does. But maybe over here, since it's a mekach ta'ot, meaning that the whole sale was reversed, and therefore they have no rights in the animal anymore. So then how does the middleman have a right to step into their shoes when their shoes aren't there anymore? They basically refunded the whole thing, said it's a mekach ta'ot. So me, he loved the toy, but bakra, anabad de toro kimte, avabshita de mechayev bakra, avagav de mekach ta'otu. And had it been for the fact that there was pshia over here, it's clear that he would have a right to go in and make a claim. And so what Tosfot says over here is that maybe the case of socher giving it to shoel is different than a normal case of shomer shemasad shomer. This Tosfot over here has a big nafkaminot for the way that you view the dinim of shomer shemasar the shomer. We spoke back on daf lamed hey lamed vav about the different formulations of what shomer shemasar the shomer, how it works. Over here, the Baalei Tosfot want to create a difference between, or a possible difference between, a socher to a shoel, where they are shomer shemasar the shomer, since the socher has rights in the animal. That gives the original owner's rights to go after the final party, versus the case of a shomer sachar and shomer chinam, where the shomer sachar has no rights in the animal, and is passing it to the other shomer may not grant rights to the original owner in the animal if it wasn't for pshiat, if it was not for the fact that there was negligence over here. So that's something important to keep in mind that many don't mention back on Daf Lamed Vav, which is the fact that Shomer Shemasa the Shomer might manifest itself in different manners depending on the nature of the relationship of the first Shomer that might impact what the Baalim's relationship was with the final Shomer. And you might, where the Tosafot is formulated here, differentiate between a Shomer Chinam that gives it to a Shomer Sachar versus a Socher that gives it to a Shoel. And the din might actually be different. And here, the reason the din is the same is because of Pshia, because of the negligence of the individuals, not because this is your classic case of Shomer, Shemasar, the Shomer, according to Rabbi Yossi. And so in the end, according to Rashi, Rami Bar Chama's position is premised on Rabbi Yossi of the Mishnah. That's what Rashi says. V'tmiya ani. Minayin Rami Bar Chama din ze? Malo le safsira ima ro'eh. What right does the safsira, the middleman broker, have to after the ro'eh? And Rashi cites the fact that the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah back on Daf Lamed Vav. On the other hand, Tosafot over here is not as certain about that. He says it's very possible, yes, that it's premised on that din of Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah. But there's another possibility over here, which is the fact that if he was a posheya, the ro'eh, then the safsira would have a right to go after him. But in this case, where the ro'eh has a claim that I put him with the rest of the animals and I wasn't a posheya, there Tosafot has a safek as to whether that's similar to that din of Rabbi Yossi, as we explained that maybe there's a difference between a socher and a shomer chinam that passes it to a shomer sachar, especially in a situation where the mekach ta'ot undoes the relationship. How gavra, the afki kshuta gabe chavre. There was this individual who deposited kshuta with his friend. Now, the translation of the word kshuta is hops, which would mean that it was used in the making of beer. On the other hand, from the nature of the Gemara over here, it sounds like that this is not the hops itself, but rather it was it's called kuskuta. Kuskuta is a member of the daughter family. They're a genus of parasitic type of plant that was used to flavor beer. And so that the kuskuta that we're speaking about here is not the hops itself, but rather something that was used to actually flavor the beer. It gave it the bitterness, or that bitter flavor that's given to it was done through the kuskuta. But that's a kuskuta, which again is a parasitic type of plant. So either one of the reason it was given to his friend to watch. He himself, the nifka, the individual, the shomer, also had his own personal pile of whether it was hops or kuskuta. He said over to the shamish of his house or his beer maker, Mehai Rami, go take from that pile. Azal Rama Meidach. He went and took from the other pile. meaning that he told him to go take from his own personal pile of kshuta. Instead, he went ahead and took from the stuff that was deposited with him. Amar Avraham, Eichani Dainu Daini Laidina. What are we going to do in this situation? If you say to the owner, the shomer, go ahead and pay you back for it. Amar Anamreile Mehai Rami. I told him to take from my pile. I didn't take him to take for the other pile. Namele the Sarse Zil Shlim. He says, well, if you tell the guy, the beer maker or the guy who was working for him, his Poel, you pay for it because you were negligent and taking the wrong thing. He didn't say to me, take from this pile, but not from the other pile. He just said, take from this pile. It made it sound like, okay, if you want to take from this pile, but if you want to take from the other pile, it wasn't a directive that said from this pile exclusively. Now, if he took a long time for the guy to come back, then it would be clear that the Balim are okay with it. So for instance, if the Balim's pile was proximate to us, it was nearby, and the pile that he had in Shmirah was far away, and then the guy went and took a long time to come back, then the Balim know for sure he's not taking them from the local pile, he went to take from the other pile. And the Balim didn't say anything, that means that they become now responsible because they knew what was happening, and they are responsible for it. On the other hand, below Shaul, in the case where there wasn't any delay or there's no tarrying, meaning that they were at the same distance, and he wouldn't know from how long it took him to get it where he went. So my psidaika. What type of loss is there here? Balim got hana'a, meaning that in the end, the Balim got the benefit of using this kshuta, and they have their own pile of kshuta over there. They could just take their own pile and give it to the guy back. They got benefit from this guy's kshuta, and instead they give him back the other one. They replace it with the kshuta. What's the big deal? He got what he needed in the end, and he gave the other guy what he needed back. And so why is there an issue? So Amar Rav Sama, Rei Derava, Dau Shichra Chalo. Because that beer turned into vinegar. Rav Ashi Amar, Bikise. It's a case where it was, Rashi calls it over here, it was bad quality hops, or bad quality kuskuta, that had thorns that were mixed in with it. And therefore, the flavoring of the beer was not done properly because of this mixture. Again, the kuskuta is a parasitic plant, and therefore when you pick it or you take out the kuskuta, many times it comes with the host plant with it. So if the host plant came with it and there was a lot of kotsim or thorns with it, then it didn't flavor the beer properly, and it actually might have ruined the beer. Then I thought, what's the loss to the owner over here? He got the benefit of the kshuta, he'll give him back the other kshuta. The Gemara is coming up with scenarios where he really didn't benefit from the kshuta. Either in a case where the beer turned to vinegar or went bad because of the kshuta, or it was bad quality kshuta over here that was put in because it was mixed with thorns. Umishalim lay dmei kise. And therefore, he has to only pay him the value or the added value. He's not going to give him back the full kshuta. So therefore, there is a loss to the original party because he had this bad quality stuff there. And therefore, when the Balim got benefit, they didn't really get the benefit that they expected from it. So he can't just hand him back the other pile of shuta. He has to pay him the value of the hana'ah. And that's why here he's not on the hook for the full responsibility because of that. Now, what this kise is, Rashi says it was a low quality or low grade kishut that was mixed in with kotsim. The Rabbeinu Chananel over here says, Kisei is kshuta she'ena mitukenet. It was not either fully ripened, or it was not ready to be used. She'adayin shrichat tikun. It still needed something to fix it up. The way the Balei Tosfot talk about it is maybe it needed to be softened. And it was in a harder state, and that if you just waited a little bit, it would have softened. So that makes it more interesting over here, because Tosfot says, because he used it now, that's what caused the problem. Had he waited and it softened, it would have been just fine. But since he used it before its time, that's what caused the problem. And now we want to know, what does he have to pay? Does he have to pay the full amount or the full value of kshuta and replace it? Or does he only pay mashenenet, what he got done off from it? Problem here is that in the end, he was not a posheya. It was the worker's fault. The worker says it's not my fault because he didn't give me all the information. So they're both trying to exempt themselves from responsibility. The Gemara says, okay, you can exempt yourself from responsibility, but you still got hana'ah. You still got benefit from utilizing the item. So the question is, what hana'ah did he get over here? So the Gemara says, if he got the hana'ah of kshuta, he should just replace the kshuta with that. I said he didn't get kshuta here because it was bad quality hops or bad quality kuskuta, and it actually either ruined the beer or it didn't flavor in the way that he wanted. So his hana is not at the full level of kshuta, and therefore does he have to replace the kshuta? The answer is no, he's not fully responsible, but he has to give him the amount or the value of the hana that he got, and that hana is below the value of the hops or the other item. Again, if you're like Rashi, where it was bad quality or with thorns, but that's what the value was, so what's the big deal? But if you're speaking like the Rabbeinu Chananel, where for a short little more time, or if he had done a little more work with it, it would have been perfectly good, then the lack of hana'ah actually causes a loss to the people who were depositing it here, and he only pays them what he got the benefit for, not the full value of the item had he waited or used it at a later time. So here, Tosfot gives other possibilities of how to deal with it with Rashi, which is it would have been worth more for animal feed. So had you given it as animal feed, it would be worth more. He doesn't have to pay for it as animal feed. He has to pay for whatever hana'ah he got from it. And that's the conclusion of the Gemara, which is neither are responsible, like the other cases we had above. I assume that the worker, the poel here, would have to take a shvua that he didn't tell him, except take from this pile, not take from the other pile. And the owner, take a shvua already, directed him to take from the pile and not the other pile. He didn't know that he was taking from the other pile. And then he would have been off the hook completely, except for the fact that he got hana'ah over here. Now that he got hana'ah, we have a din in general that if you get hana'ah, you pay for the hana'ah that you got. And so therefore he has to pay for the hana'ah, even though that's worth, according to Rashi, less than selling it as animal feed, or for the Rabbeinu Chananel, had he waited, it would have been worth full-fledged kushuta. Nevertheless, he pays the lower amount, which is the hana'ah that he got from it. All right, and we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Mem Gimel Amud Aleph.